Okay. Here's my death ray. Be careful. Oh, you want my mic too?
I'm just going to talk here.
Okay.
Ready? Okay. I'm Susan Lee with Aspen Environmental Group, and with me here is Brewster Birdsall, also from Aspen. Before we dive into a description of what we're doing in the environmental aspect, I wanted to give you just a little overview. What we usually do at Aspen, and what I think a lot of you might be familiar with in the environmental context, is work like an environmental impact report or an environmental impact statement, where we look at a specific project in a lot of detail, and we'll look at 10 or 15 different environmental disciplines, and we'll follow, you know, every aspect of a route geographically. The other thing we've done here with the ISO is we've done some regional studies looking at regional transmission permitting constraints, where we're looking at a smaller region, but again, much more focused land use based detailed constraints. What we're doing in this study is not that. We are looking at a Westride regional, and unlike the economic study, here we are looking out of California. We're looking both in-state and out-of-state. So it's a very different environmental report than what you will normally see. And because of that, we've narrowed basically the scope of the work to the environmental disciplines that we think really are most relevant to this kind of study. So, and Brewster's going to talk through each one of these disciplines. What we're really looking for you, and we'll explain to you again, is feedback on whether we've chosen the right ones and whether the kinds of attributes for each one of them make sense. Again, here's our little checklist on where we are today. You can see we're at the very last little arrow in there in the discussion, but remember that I guess we'll take a break after this, but we do have an hour after we're done to kind of loop back for general discussion. So we'll have time for Q&A on environmental only, but then we'll have the broader Q&A after all of this. So this is our overview of what we're going to cover in the environmental process today. We're going to talk about our methodology as a whole. We're going to talk about how we use the model data that we get from Brattle and E3 that you've heard about this morning. We'll go through for each of the environmental disciplines what the impact indicators are, and that's really one of the factors we're looking for feedback on. We have, in addition to 5 environmental disciplines, we also are looking separately from the economic group on disadvantaged communities. And that's one where I think you'll see pulling together more of the sort of health effects related to air quality on disadvantaged communities. And Brewster has a series of maps he'll show you about how we're going to do that. And then finally, as with all the other groups, we're really looking for your input. We've focused here, and we'll bring this up again at the end, what the topics are that we're looking for your feedback on. Obviously, we're happy to hear anything, but, you know, did we choose the right range of environmental topics? Do the indicators that we've selected make sense? And kind of is the scale of everything appropriate to what you're expecting, what you think will be useful? So I will turn it over to Brewster, and he's going to talk through the details.
Thanks, Susan, and my name is Brewster Birdsall, Senior Associate at Aspen Environmental Group. As Susan explained, our methodology is really needs to be in sync and tailored to the kind of information that we're going to be getting from the rest of the partner teams and the modelers. The legislation dictates the scale of the study, which is vast for an environmental review, and we will be taking California, but dividing it into zones depending on how the portfolio build out is defined, and then we'll be looking at the rest of the West, also in broad terms. The definition of what we will be assessing, or in our case, the project really, is going to be this makeup of different scenarios, and we've heard about the 3 basic scenarios that Brattle and E3 are working on assembling. And so where Aspen sits is downstream of the resolve model and downstream of the production cost simulation model. The depth of our environmental impact work will be really dictated by the kind of information that we get from those modeling efforts. So I have a slide. This is essentially environmental assessment 101. I wanted to just take a step back for just a broad range of stakeholders today and explain how we are going to approach our work in reporting the environmental impacts. The first step in our world is to describe the regulatory setting and baseline environmental conditions. And by that I mean we'll provide a narrative in the work that explains some of the pertinent environmental rules that really provide a backstop for basic environmental protections. And this will be very high level, and of course you can always research this kind of thing on your own. But we have to include some narrative because it really puts the impacts into context. The second part of the first step is to document the baseline environmental conditions, and that helps us to identify which geographic locations are sensitive for which attributes. And in this case, we'll be using a lot of GIS tools, and it'll be very data-driven, relying on public data sets to show us where environmental resources are constrained or are stressed out in the baseline. The second basic step in environmental assessment is to take a look at the build-outs or what we're going to call our basic alternatives or the results of the modeling effort from Brattle and E3. And we'll be looking at those build-outs not by using any particular model, like as an economic assessment. There's a separate model where you can feed the outputs of the energy sector modeling into some model and identify an environmental impact. But what we'll do is we'll have a more tailored really discussion and probably a GIS analysis of where the potential build-out locations are likely to co-locate with environmentally sensitive resources or impaired baseline environmental conditions. And to the extent that co-location occurs, then that would be an indicator of an impact or potentially environmental benefit if a change is happening in the opposite direction. The third big step in my environmental review 101 would be the step of documenting what we learned from the analysis of the impacts and how to characterize or monitor actions that go on in the future to make it some kind of a check and balance system, or if there are trends that can be tracked by the agencies or by the implementing parties. And we'll take a stab at making recommendations on what can be tracked. So I have two slides to describe the different modeling tools that you heard a lot about this morning and how they will be fed into the environmental assessment. The first slide is just my interpretation, and this ends up looking very simplistic, but my interpretation of what the Resolve model will be giving us. And in our view, the Resolve model gives us these opportunities for infrastructure development and the locations of potential capacity additions and transmission additions would be identified really by zone or between zones, and that's about the best level of geographic specificity that we're going to get. But the Resolve model will give us information in terms of numbers of megawatts, and you've already heard little bits about the potential size of transmission additions. What we have then is the challenge of translating that to something that's meaningful in an on the ground kind of an assessment. The second big part of our description of scenarios will be coming from the production cost simulation, and we're not production modelers, we're not energy modelers. What we will do is we'll be taking, however, the information that Brattle and the production cost modeling provide, and that information is built up unit by unit from how the system will respond to the various scenarios. And we'll have to aggregate some of that information geographically, but it will show us the megawatt hours produced and or displaced by generation or transmission additions. It will also show us how fuels are being used in the different scenarios and the types of generating units that are being called upon. And key to our work is the emissions estimates that will be coming out of production cost modeling. And this is good news for Aspen. We don't have to generate emission estimates on our own, but we do have to translate the kinds of information that comes out of the production cost model and put it into a meaningful context. And for the example of criteria air pollutants, if the production cost simulation is showing changes in a non-attainment area, well, then we will be able to at least identify the co-location of those changes with those exacerbated baseline conditions. I'll get into that in a little more detail as I go further. So environmental analysis is really driven by location. It's driven by geography. It's driven by the specificity that you have available to you in your project or in whatever you are analyzing. And in this case, what we have are within California, we have renewable zones that are built into the resolve model. And this map here that I'm showing gives you the 11 zones that the resolve model is selecting resources from and between. And this gives you a sense of the kind of scale of aggregation that we're talking about for the inside California renewable buildout. For the remainder of California, we'll be probably dividing into CREZ-like zones. And when I say CREZ, for those of you who aren't tracking the Renewable Energy Transmission Initiative or the California CPC long-term procurement planning processes, these are renewable energy zones. The C stands for California. The resolve model isn't looking at those zones in a zone-by-zone basis, but is aggregating them and also aggregating the newer version of these zones, which are super CREZs. I probably won't go back into that acronym world, but I wanted to give you a sense at least of the kinds of scale that we're looking at in terms of the changes between zones. I have another sentence here on the slide that says the results of the production cost simulation would have to be aggregated as well. And as I say, within California, we have these zones that are built into the resolve model. We would probably also use similar zones for the production cost simulation results. My next slide shows you the region of assessment, and you're probably saying to yourself, well, yes, I study geography. What I'm not drawing intentionally are the kinds of zones that would be aggregated for the environmental impact study. We want to retain some flexibility in how we approach the rest of the West, and we are really going to be driven by the kinds of results and the kinds of information that we get from the other partners in the overall SB 350 studies. Within the West, we know that the Western Governors Association back a few years ago established hubs for renewable energy development, and some of those hubs are being used as proxies in E3's resolve model for attractive opportunities of out-of-state renewable development. And really the hubs that seem to be rising to the surface are Arizona West and New Mexico East and Wyoming East. And I can say geographically Arizona West is a hub that's centered around Harquahela substation near Palo Verde. But aside from that, we don't have a way of carving up the western states to assess environmental impacts other than through zones like that. I'm happy to stop and take questions on this part of the work. It's a little bit open-ended, but I'm also trying to remain flexible to take the results from the rest of the team and create some kind of meaningful analysis without showing on a map exactly what we may end up with. Are there questions?
Hi, Rachel Golden, the Large Scale Solar Association. I just want to make sure I am understanding your approach here. Are you going to be looking at only the changes within those super CREZs, or are you looking statewide? I'm just thinking that we have overall changes in dispatch of gas plants, which may or may not be where the renewables are located. I'm trying to figure out.
Right. For the production cost modeling results, we'll have to assign some location to everything that comes from production cost modeling. And California has renewable energy zones to cover the whole state. So, you know, in the L.A. Basin, we will have the L.A. Basin and Orange County, and then there's San Diego and San Diego Central and East. And we can take that level of granularity from the production cost modeling results. And then we can tally up California as a grand total and compare it to the rest of the West. But I think the combination of the resolve model output and the production cost simulation output, we will be able to discern changes between zones in California and changes in production, say, for example, between the Central Valley and the more desert counties. Does that answer the question?
I think so. Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Hi, Carl Zakella again. A couple of observations. One has to do with co-locating. You mentioned co-locating environmental impacts and development. Obviously, there's a third level to this that reduces the footprint, and that is the optimization. What's the load profile or the generation shape in those areas? There's been a lot of work done on this by NREL, so I just wanted to call your attention to that as we're looking at places. Areas that have uncorrelated variability with California's renewables obviously have more value from an environmental perspective because they reduce the amount of acreage you need for the projects, they improve transmission line utilization so you can build less, and generally reduce the overall environmental footprint. So if we're not thinking about optimization at the same time we're thinking about co-locating with environmental impacts, we're missing, I think, an important environmental factor. Secondly, first of all, I think you're looking at a lot of the right things. We talk about renewable energy zones, but a couple of things you didn't mention. I presume you'll be looking at some of the state zoning efforts that have been gone on, and BLM's solar energy zone programmatic environmental impact statement created renewable energy zones in 6 states. So those need to be factored in. We're looking at those same very same areas as we look at regional transmission planning in WestConnect and other parts of the Western Interconnection under FERC Order 1000. So I wanted to call that to your attention, something that if you're not thinking about it, you need to factor it in, along with things like the Arizona Restoration Design Energy Project, which created zones, and Nevada's done zones, and Colorado's done zones, et cetera. So lots of information about potential sources for generation. And finally, at WEC, we've created a tool called the Environmental Data Working Groups Data Viewer. It categorizes environmental impacts or potential environmental impacts on a landscape level using GIS data down to half a kilometer resolution and ranks them according to relative environmental risk. It has new functionality just been revealed this week that includes being able to draw proposed routes. If you're looking at generic transmission, you don't want to pick a particular project, as was mentioned earlier today, you can actually draw it in on the viewer, and it will give you your mileage, it'll give you your capital costs estimate done using the WEC capital cost tool calculator, and also mitigation costs, environmental mitigation costs that comes from study work that was done at WEC over the last several years. Extremely valuable tool for doing cost analysis, but also for helping you avoid in the determination about whether or not you can do a line from point A to point B, substation A to substation B, in a least environmentally impactful way. So those are important tools. They're out there now. You don't have to do them, anything except use them. And if you're familiar with DataBasin and you're comfortable with that, the same environmental risk data has been put into DataBasin for the San Joaquin Valley project. So all statewide risk factors that were identified in the WEC tool are also available in that platform. It doesn't have the same functionality I just talked about in terms of drawing transmission lines on the map. That you'll have to go to the WEC data viewer for. But it sounds like you're making a good start here. It's not as blank a sheet of paper as your map would lead people to believe. There's a lot of information out there.
Absolutely. Thank you, Carl. And I know Carl's probably been the most involved in this kind of work, absolutely right. We will be going back to your comments on previous literature and previous work We'll be going back to the BLM programmatic EISs to look at the zones. We'll see how they match up with the kinds of resources that the portfolio model is selecting. In a sense, a lot of the opportunities that you're speaking of in terms of highly viable renewables in Colorado or elsewhere, in more towards the Front Range or the Rocky Mountains. We won't be looking so closely there if the resolve portfolios don't point us there. So we won't, this study, especially for the rest of the West, will be taking a much more focused look inside California. But when you talk of the Western states in a larger sense, we're not trying to provide a full assessment of Wyoming wind versus New Mexico wind. I mean, we may identify some differences in the potential environmental consequences and the amount of acres disturbed would be affected by the quality of the resource. And so we can look at that. But when it comes down to specific siting challenges, we won't be able to address those in other than generalities. And thanks for the update on the environmental data working group tools. We've been watching them and really waiting for a chance to use them. So now we are, and we intend to.
Mark Joseph for Q. So I didn't quite understand your answer to Rachel's question. Will you be characterizing the change in non-GHG emissions by air basin?
We will take the results that come from the production cost modeling, and those results are coming on a unit-by-unit basis. So if you see a power plant in the Central Valley changing its operation in response to renewables coming from Arizona, then yes, that is information that we will have, and we can aggregate that information into these kinds of zones so that we would discern whether that's happening in the Westlands, Krez, or in the Mojave Desert.
This is why I'm getting confused, because the Krezes are where new renewable development would take place. The gas-fired power plants are almost exclusively not in these zones. They're in the white space. They're in the L.A. Basin. They're in San Diego. They're in the other places. Those are the air basins. You know, obviously, there's overlap in the San Joaquin Valley. But those are the places where you need to characterize the change in emissions from gas-fired plants.
Absolutely. And, I mean, the gas-fired power plants are located, well, wherever the transmission in the gas is. And we recognize that. Our report will not be limited to just these renewable energy zones. I'm showing them as to give you an example of the kind of scale that we have to use in our assessment, because the portfolio for renewable energy development will be defined in terms of these zones, meaning some wind in Northern California or some in Westlands. But you're right, the separate part of the work that we'll have to be focusing on is the results of the production cost simulation. And that's where we have more latitude in how we aggregate things. And we do have to have we will be showing the information for what's happening on the coast, LA Basin, compared to San Diego coast.
Well, okay, then let me suggest that a good level of aggregation would be by air basin, since that's how we do, obviously, all the other air quality work.
That is one possible level of aggregation, and that would be very easy to implement, straightforward. So this is a stakeholder process, and that exact kind of comment is what we're looking for.
A related question about aggregation, Dave Marcus for Q. You're going to choose to aggregate the emissions data, but you'll have the underlying data at a unit-by-unit level, correct?
That's true.
And have you thought about making some way that data is available for people who want to do a deep dive?
That's a good question. And
online appendix or whatever?
I may turn to the rest of my panel.
Let me just jump in. This is Judy Chan from Brattle. Sorry. We will have the underlying data, and as a requirement of the legislation, we will need to make data available. So the answer is yes. The one thing that this team has discussed, however, is that the production cost simulation represents plants sometimes not so uniquely to the units. So the unit information might be at a level that's generic. Therefore, therefore, we can only interpret the results without constraint, right? So we don't want people to interpret the results as, oh, this particular plant will increase or decrease its emissions when we're talking about 2030. We would like some level of aggregation so that we can make a description of the results, but I think to interpret each individual unit and know deterministically exactly how it's going to perform in the future is probably too precise of an interpretation. So we just want to be cautious about how we interpret the results, but the data, underlying data, will be available.
Okay, but I can understand, you know, saying, well, we can't tell between Palomar 2 and Palomar 3, or Palomar 2 and Otay Mesa 1, which one's really going to run at 50% capacity factor and which one's going to run at 60. And when you aggregate them to the San Diego ABCD, it doesn't matter because they're both in the San Diego ABCD. But if you're also saying that you can't tell whether Mountain View versus Palomar, which one's really running, and those are in two different APCDs, then your aggregated data doesn't actually have any valid information in it. So I'm not sure what you're saying about the untrustworthiness of the unit data.
David, I think Judy is explaining that we will have the production cost results on this unit-by-unit basis. And if we are aggregating on an air basin level, then and I think that is probably one appropriate level. It may be that we divide air basins into smaller segments to get a better look at things, because some of the air basins are just quite so huge. But clearly the difference between Mountain View being in the LA basin or something up in the cool water area compared to San Diego, I think we will be identifying those kinds of differences. I'm optimistic that we will provide that kind of information.
Yeah, I would reinforce that. I think the concern we have over about the unit-specific data is, you know, I can't tell you at 3 o'clock 15 years from now if Mountain View is going to run at 200 megawatts or will not run at all that day. But the production costs would give you that level of granularity. So certainly take your point that the dispatch of the gas fleet, to the extent you can sync it up with the air basin, has the most value. And I think that's something we can take back to look at how we would do that.
And a different aggregation question. Are you going to be able to say anything useful about impacts of new transmission?
Useful, yes, I hope so. I mean, the point of the effort is to provide information to the legislature. The information will be very very high level, and we aren't looking at corridors, but we may be using something like the EDWG WEC tools to say here are high risk lands between one point and the other point, or one zone and the other zone. And those high-risk lands are, meaning highly constrained lands, are made up of XYZ kinds of resources, and take the transmission at that level. So this won't be a corridor study. This won't be a siting study.
Booster, I would just introduce too. You know, we're talking about within California, but we also have to look at these environmental impacts the rest of the West, and as Booster mentioned, you know, we're still trying to sort out what would be the best representation of that, and that's an area where we would welcome stakeholder input. You know, we're very reluctant to go too granular with regard to that, but I know there's a lot of concern about coal emissions, for instance, within the northeastern part of the Western Interconnect, and how can we create an aggregation that might be able to shed some insights on that. I know that's been a concern in the context of EIM as well, and to date we've not seen very de minimis coal dispatch under EIM in terms of transfers coming into the ISO, but that's something we'll need to look at in the context of this study. So thoughts on how we might aggregate that information for purposes of outside of California would be welcome.
Travis Ritchie with Sierra Club. One of my questions kind of leading into that is, so outside of California, will there be the granularity in the system to understand the unit-by-unit dispatch? And if there is, where is that information coming from the various, you know, balancing authorities that, you know, most of which haven't even, you know, suggested that they would be a part of this at this time?
Travis, I think that goes to the portfolio modeling, really. The unit-by-unit distinctions are going to be built up, or sorry, not portfolio modeling, but production cost simulation. I mean, those assumptions are built into the units and how they respond.
So they are unit-by-unit assumptions outside of California being made?
Yes, that's inherent to the production cost model.
Yeah. But again, I want to stress again, we have to guard against putting too much confidence, precision around these production cost dispatches. And so that's where this notion of an aggregation that, you know, the model is giving you an indicative result of how resources like this in this geographic area may be redispatched under a regional market. But I don't want to say, you know, we can't say with any confidence that, you know, Mojave is going to be dispatched like this or, you know, this coal plant's going to be dispatched like that. So there's a kind of a flop level of precision in these production cost models when you get down to unit-specific dispatch that we just have to recognize.
Thanks, Keith. We'll just I'll move forward, and I'll have time at the end to circle back for more questions. Have a couple of slides moving forward to touch base on the kinds of topics that we expect to address. So following what I anticipate to be the general outline of our work, we, like I mentioned before, we will be providing the regulatory setting to really establish the framework in which to view the capacity additions and the changes in system operation. This is just a snapshot of the kinds of programs that we need to keep our eye on. There was a question earlier today about SB 1368, and I view that as a baseline state policy, all scenarios going forward would adhere to that policy. All scenarios in this modeling effort would adhere to that, just as AB 32 and cap and trade rules would be in force, and in force in a consistent way throughout all of this study horizon. So my next slide is sort of a table of contents. This is this shows you the five environmental areas and environmental disciplines, as well as disadvantaged communities that we'll have to be touching upon. This particular range of topics is one where the stakeholder comment form and blank template is open to question or open to suggestions and questions. Are we capturing the right topics? I have a slide for each one of these topics to give you an idea of what kind of environmental impacts we'll be looking for. In general, in each of the environmental disciplines, we'll be looking for directional changes. Is the electrical system going to be incrementing upwards or downwards for each of these resources in each of the zones or in which zones and which ones are incrementing upwards versus downwards? First is air quality. This is a topic that is going to largely be driven by the production cost modeling results. So when the production cost modeling shows us the changes in megawatt hours produced and the changes in fuel use between the different scenarios, we'll have a very robust amount of information to draw upon and make some conclusions and assessments. We will map non-attainment zones throughout the West and can show and show changes within those zones or within those air basins. We'll be taking a close look at disadvantaged communities. I want to come back to that though at the end of my list of six topics. But these slides give you an idea of the kinds of uh, kinds of questions we'll be asking ourselves as we review the portfolios and the production cost results. Second topic, greenhouse gas emissions. Again, driven largely by the production cost simulations. So we'll be looking at changes in fossil fuel consumption across the entire study region, changes inside California versus the rest of West, and we'll be looking for fuel and natural gas in particular, and how changes in production may be picking up those fuels. The topic of land use and visual resources is going to be broadly construed here. We won't be talking about community zoning, but we'll be talking instead about high-level environmental constraints and land use constraints. And we'll touch on the topic of aesthetics, although this is much more related to transmission additions, and we won't have location-specific transmission additions. But the land use topic we take to encompass tribal concerns as well as farmland conversion potential and proximity or co-location of parks and wilderness areas and scenic highways and that kind of thing. This is one area where we would rely on the WEC work that has been done by the Environmental Data Working Group and would be taking those kinds of data sets and putting them into our assessment. Biological resources and ecology. Again, this is, as with land use, this is a topic that would be more driven by the portfolios that are generated from the resolve model rather than the production cost model. So where changes in megawatt capacity are identified as being potential, we'd take a look at the some high-level information on sensitive areas. And what we're really going to be trying to focus on is whether or not the potential for land disturbance is occurring or overlapping with known sensitive biological communities and what those communities are, being different in the different geographies of the West. The fifth topic area is water supply, and to this I really mean to focus, I think, on groundwater. We'll be looking at a little bit both the portfolios as well as the production cost modeling results. This is kind of going to take a hybrid of both system operations as well as system build-out. And we'll be looking for whether or not capacity additions are occurring in constrained or depleted groundwater areas. And some things that we want to be sensitive to are developing solar in areas where water resources are not abundant. And we recognize that aside from thermal generation, which relies on water for cooling, there is water use for solar photovoltaic as well as solar thermal development. So we'll want to touch on that as well. And I promised a separate column on disadvantaged communities, and I'll pause here for a question.
Great. Thanks. This is Rachel Gold again with LSA. I had a couple of questions. One was on the land impacts, and you said there were a couple of indicators. One was farmland, and the other one was tribal. We're now seeing solar projects being co-developed with a number of tribes, so we have a little bit of tension around that as an indicator. And it goes for farmland. There are places where we can have very productive use of marginal farmland, and actually we're saving water in those areas. So I think there's a lot to be kind of looked at in those assumptions.
Oh, excuse me. I absolutely recognize this concern, and to use the word of the economist, so we're agnostic to whether this is a positive or negative, really. The co-location, the coincidence of farmland resources and mappable farm resources with these zones of potential development will be an indicator to us. It won't be necessarily a pro or a con. Tribal concerns, similarly, we can flag these topics, but we don't have site-specific information. We're not going to be saying, well, the Westlands CREZ is deriving its name from the Westlands part of the Central Valley, but the CREZ itself is so vast that it goes from one side to the other of the Central Valley. So certainly there are going to be development opportunities on a local level in many of these topics. But we want to identify where the co-location is greatest, I think.
Carl Sekela, just wanted to point out, we just finished the San Joaquin Valley Solar Assessment, or initiative rather, that has identified least conflict areas in the San Joaquin Valley. There's no need to have an overly broad area to consider as being, open to everything when we know these areas are agreed upon by both agricultural interests, renewable energy generators, environmental interests. They're very well vetted through this process, and they're in GIS form in the database and tool. So as we look within it, the Westlands Crest, fine, use that as your broad area, but if you're trying to assess areas that have lower environmental land use conflicts, I really think it'd be really an oversight not to use those data. They're so well vetted by constituency groups, they're well delineated in the GIS data, the database. The governor's office helped sponsor this thing. It was done by the University of California. And it's not some, back of the envelope kind of thing.
Absolutely, Carl. We haven't decided how we'll take information like that. That's at what I'll just say sub-zone level. But aside from the Central Valley work, there's the DRECP and the development focus areas there. These kinds of efforts we are well aware of, and we'll have to draw some of that literature into our work. But I'm not sure that we will be going much deeper than that. I mean, we can show how those areas line up within the zones and portray them, and maybe leave it at that.
Well, let me just point out something that Janet said earlier about capacity. You know generally by the scale of those areas what the general megawatt capacity potential is. So if you have a certain level that you're looking at for in-state resources and we're looking there, which we should be looking because of disadvantaged community impacts, among other things, the socio-environmental impacts are, there's good payoff going to these places and they're close to load. So, there's an opportunity there, I think, to quantitatively look at them in terms of the amount of megawatt capacity that's needed and what those impacts would be. And actually, it'd be a fairly straightforward environmental analysis, too.
Right. And it could be a side-by-side comparison of the potential as defined by those processes versus what the portfolio is selecting in terms of resources. Okay, I'll move forward, and my wrapping up portion is focused on disadvantaged communities. We'll treat this as a separate discussion in the assessment as far as I can see at this point. And to take a step back, there's talk of disadvantaged communities, and there is a definition and the metrics that have been presented by David already, show you the work that's out there on disadvantaged communities. I'm going to highlight a couple of words on this slide for those of us who were sort of new to the topic. The definition is a community that's disproportionately burdened by pollution or vulnerable to pollution, and that means that there are two components to the definition. The burden is a component that takes into account the existing air quality, water pesticide use in the area. And then the separate component is the vulnerability, which takes into account the more socioeconomic factors of each area. Fortunately, this information is available at a very relatively fine-grained basis at a census tract level, and it's very, very well vetted. Talk about how disadvantaged communities may be addressed in the environmental study. These are the kinds of impacts that we'll be looking for. The changes in adverse health effects are driven really by criteria pollutant emissions, and so the level of aggregation that we have in terms of criteria air pollutants will help us to see whether or not those changes in emissions are coinciding with disadvantaged communities.
or likely to coincide. Provide a little bit more depth on disadvantaged communities. We're aiming to stay consistent and in harmony with the work that's been done for SB 535. We propose to take the results of the Cal EnviroScreen tool, which is the California Community's Environmental Health Screening tool, and the results are posted online and very easy to access by following the links through OEHA, Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, and you can scroll around California and see where your census tract sits in terms of categorization. The tool is new and recently vetted. The data that's available to us right now or available to everyone is from November 2015. As I mentioned before, the two basic indicators are categories of indicators. And the first category is the pollution burden, and then the second category is the population characteristics of the census tract. This information is very data-driven. We will be taking it and using this as a baseline to help us focus our environmental work. I'll show a couple of images to give you an idea of how these burdens are distributed around the state. And unfortunately, the thumbnail image is a little bit small, but it gives you a sense where the blue areas are the most disadvantaged and the green areas are the least in terms of existing baseline pollution. And when I say baseline pollution, I really mean this aggregate score of the 12 different indicators. I've listed in the bullet form just the primary ones, but it's very comprehensive and takes a kind of holistic view of the existing pollution burden in these communities. And you can see urban areas of Los Angeles Basin showing up in dark blue, and the largest prevalence of dark blue being in the Central Valley, where the air pollution and other factors, including drinking water availability and pollution, are very huge and intractable problems. So that's the pollution burden layout, and that you may not see the shapes drawn on this map are the shapes of those creses that I was showing on the previous maps. And when I was speaking of the Westlands shape, the shape of the crez itself goes way up into the Sierra foothills, but the valley floor is where the burdened populations are. The second main characteristic, aside from pollution burden, is the population characteristic, and this is an aggregate of seven factors, including the prevalence of children or elderly, so ages of the population is a factor. Some socioeconomic terms are built into this score as well, and the darker pink is the census tracts that are most highly burdened or most vulnerable, really, for population characteristics. The key word is vulnerability. So the darker pink you can see is the pink is spread more throughout the state, but you have the rural desert southeast as being most pink, and again the Central Valley also being largely categorized as vulnerable or disadvantaged according to this term. The overall score of disadvantaged communities that we saw in the presentation from Bear a moment ago is a combination of those two factors on a census tract by census tract basis, and we've already seen these colors earlier today, but in this case the census tracts that are scoring with the highest, and that means the most disadvantaged or most vulnerable and most exposed to existing pollution, are red, and green is better. And as you can see, the kinds of renewable zones that we're talking about, and we draw those boundaries on top of these census tracts, again, Central Valley zones
are ones that we're going to be paying special attention to. Westlands and then further north, Los Banos, and up into the Solano northern central valley, northern San Joaquin Valley at least. And also the desert southeast of Riverside East and Greater Imperial. I want to make a point that this is baseline information. This doesn't include or cover any forecasts of population or pollution trends. So this provides for us, as I said, a context within which to view the portfolio additions and the changes in production cost model or changes in production output. That's my last topic slide, and I'll take a question before closing up. Mark?
Thanks. Can you go back to your first slide on disadvantaged communities, which says number 6, disadvantaged communities, and has a few bullets?
Yes.
That one. So the very first bullet there, addition of generation, are you going to be categorizing that? I mean, I understand if it were gas-fired generation, that would definitely be a burden. How about the addition of solar generation in disadvantaged communities? Is that a burden or a benefit?
Well, we'll have to identify that. And is it a burden or is it an exacerbation of the disadvantaged community? I'm going to probably leave that kind of conclusion to the broader study. Certainly, when new renewables are developed, there's going to be construction effects, and there are some environmental effects. We will talk about those. Those are short term. What we are looking to do in our environmental study work, I think, as a general theme, is identify the directions of changes. We're going to we'll have to aggregate and somehow harmonize the results in some kind of comparison of scenarios where we can show the pluses and minuses between the different scenarios. But I recognize that that the new development of renewables in disadvantaged communities may have economic perks.
Next, that was my question, which is the direction of the arrow? And I would suggest that there are certainly many now who are getting construction jobs, particularly people who are otherwise unskilled and may or may not have a high school diploma, but are getting jobs, would definitely view this as a benefit.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and it certainly came up in the earlier discussion with David on the economic impact for disadvantaged communities. So that's something we'll take a look at, see how we can capture that.
We do have a Q&A scheduled for the very end. We kind of skipped break, so what I propose is that we take a quick break, come back here, and then we can dive into a deeper discussion. Thank you, Keith. We do have one hand raised, so we'll go ahead and take the question in the queue, Tim. And just a reminder to please identify yourself before asking your question.
All right, and Christina, we actually have two callers in the queue now, but going first to Julia, your line is open.
Hi, this is Julia May from Communities for a Better Environment. I think that was Mark Joseph who said asked the question in the direction that I was trying to go. I'm trying to figure out how you guys are going to deal with policy in California that's working to site distributed generation solar in disadvantaged communities. Many communities, especially places like Southeast LA and Wilmington in the Harbor area, in Los Angeles, are heavily burdened by fossil fuel sources and are seeking to replace these with solar distributed sources. I'm trying to figure out how that kind of state policy and local policy would feed into this process. It seems like part of it is going to be in your environmental impacts analysis. Part of it might be in the production modeling, but could you shed some light on that? Because many communities are seeking distributed generation locally, which, as Mark mentioned, reduces or does provide jobs. There are some environmental impacts. There are also some advantages of not having to transmit long distances, and there's also an issue sort of energy democracy. And there are specifically state laws and policies that are promoting local distributed generation in disadvantaged communities. So how will that be taken into account?
This is Keith Casey. I'll take a shot at it, and maybe others on the panel can chime in. But for the most part, we're holding the development of renewables at the distribution level constant across scenarios. So we're really focusing on the change that moving to a regional market would have on wholesale level, central station, large-scale renewable projects. So I think under that approach, we would not be changing or looking to capture the impact of what would be happening at a local distribution level. But I'll look to others. Arnie, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is Arnie Olson. I mean, I would just add that we have in all three of the scenarios 14,600 megawatts of distributed rooftop PV assumed to be added under the state's net energy metering program. So I think there is a lot of distributed local PV in the cases that would reflect exactly the kind of priorities that you were talking about.
That's helpful. Is there any implication of where those would be sited or changes in your modeling based on a focus that would provide more of those resources in disadvantaged communities?
I mean, from the portfolio level, there's certainly nothing that we're seeing at the bulk grid level that would affect the location of those resources. So we assume these resources are added pursuant to a state policy that continues to exist regardless of whether there's regional integration at the wholesale level or not. You know, we don't see what, at least from the portfolio development perspective, I don't see a lot of impacts from that state level, you know, bulk grid level activity onto that, you know, state policy driven retail, you know, distribution system activity.
Okay, thanks. One last thing. I think this does come into play in the environmental impacts and benefits analysis. So I'm wondering if there's any feedback. If you guys identify negative impacts, are you looking at alternatives that would solve the problem in terms of siting, you know, clean energy in a different location? How would you deal with impacts you find? By proposing alternatives, or how does that happen?
Well, that's a good question. And an overall component of our environmental study will be to look for solutions where we identify problems. We are committed to that. I'm not sure I can answer the question any better than that at this point, but. To answer your question shortly, yes, I think we will be looking to identify solutions if there are, for example, a co-location of fossil fuel emissions in these known and mapped disadvantaged communities.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, Tim, the next question.
My name is Deirdre Kendall. I'm at the Energy Commission. Quick question. You mentioned these environmental data working group tools, and I'm interested in getting information on where to obtain these online. And in general, for all these things, people kept mentioning a bunch of tools that are available, that it would be great to have for all of them, knowing what is publicly available for free and where.
Yeah, thank you. This is Keith Casey. I'm actually going to ask a favor and a homework assignment of Carl Zakella, if he could, in his written comments, provide links to some of the data sources you mentioned in your comments, Carl. I think that would be helpful to everyone.
Yeah, this is Carl. I'm happy to do that. Just for general knowledge, if folks wanted to not wait that long, if you go to the WEC website and you search on the Environmental Data Working Group, or the Environmental Data Viewer, it'll pop up. It is free. It is an open platform for anyone to use. As I mentioned, we dump the data right into the Data Basin tool. So if you've worked on the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan, you know how to use that tool. You can get at those data there as well. So, and I will put the links in my comments, Keith.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll take a break. We'll return at 3:30, and we'll go through the next steps and then also have a detailed Q&A. We're going to get started again, so please take your seats. I know. Be at the stakeholders'